This is the third session in a series of three that deal with self-identity and relationships. The previous two dealt with the problems or pathology, and today we're all assembled to find out what the solution is, the answer, the cure-all. Well, I'm eager to find that one out myself. The material that I'm using is the emphasis is communication. So today's title is Saying What You Mean and Meaning What You Say. And the material that I'm using was developed at the University of Minnesota. It initially was a research project dealing with basically college students who were about to get married, and the research was attempting to find out what kind of assistance could be provided these premarital couples so that their relationship had some durability and was more satisfying than without. The result of that was quite satisfying, and so the researchers Miller, Nunley, and Wackman came out with this book, which is now out of print. It's called Alive and Aware: How to Improve Your Relationships Through Better Communication. If you see a copy of it around someplace, snag it. It's a marvelous book. It's very easy to read. It has a lot of helpful illustrations in it. It basically talks about, however, college age population. So once it succeeded well with that group, they tried to generalize it and in fact market it in a syndicated way. There was a workbook with that one. They combined both the workbook and that textbook, say, into this one called Talking Together, Couple Communication 1. This is a textbook and a workbook. At the end of each chapter, there's exercises. And the illustrations have been reduced in number. It's considerably shorter in length. And the illustrations have also been generalized for a wider age population. And you can make contacts in your community and find out who is a certified trainer. And so you can go to a 4-session training experience of 3 hours each session in this. A lot of groups in the Midwest following that, since that's where that organization was born. ACME is not too well known on the West Coast because it comes out of Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And if you have trouble locating somebody who teaches this, or you want to just make further contacts, I have a brochure over on a piano bench that advertises their material. They have other programs as well, and I think they're worth looking into. This course now succeeded very well, so they had a second generation of success. But this isn't really a trade book. You wouldn't go to the bookstore and buy it and read it all by yourself, necessarily. I mean, you can, but it's not designed to be a trade book. So then the same authors, plus one, came out with Straight Talk, which is now in paperback, and it's on the butcher block in the bookstore here, paperback edition of this. So if you're interested in the material that we're about to cover, that's available with this book here. A new way to get closer to others by saying what you really mean. They came up with a good title. I think they're a copy in mine.
Maybe it should be the other way, meaning what you really say.
Well, I think both are good. That's why I said saying what you mean and meaning what you say. It's kind of like when you're sworn in, you know, they don't just say, well, will you tell the truth? You know, you say to tell the truth, to tell nothing but the truth, and to tell the whole truth. Right, that's involved. So, what I think makes this material so helpful is they say not only talk to your partner, and that may be the person with whom you work or the person with whom you're married or whatever the relationship is, whether it's teacher and student. The encouragement is not only talk to them, not only be polite to them or be considerate or be caring or a lot of other admonitions, but the how-tos, the very simple things that are necessary for implementing good intentions and doing so without being abrasive, without assaulting the other person, and being clear both about what you want to communicate as well as how it's heard. The tool, the framework, is this thing that you now have in your hand, the awareness wheel. And obviously, in the course of 1 hour, we're not going to do a 24-hour class, which is what this would involve. But it'll be an introduction to it. By the way, I have 4 copies of this book. They're $9 each. So if somebody really wants to pursue it, I'm willing to part with these if you're willing to part with $9 a piece. Yeah, they're up here. Okay, the awareness wheel is where I will start, and then what I'll do is ask you for some examples of communication problems, and we'll try to illustrate the awareness wheel that way. And then if we'll see how the conversation or discussion here goes, but one thing I'm suggesting is we can take a few minutes where you actually try to use this, either with somebody that's sitting close to you or just as a mental exercise, and then we'll reconvene, so to speak, and process it through and respond to questions. Does that sound agreeable? Okay, introducing the awareness wheel. I'm not going to take the time to make this quite as neat as on paper. First part up here has to do with sense data. Now what that means, that when I want to communicate to somebody else, the first step has to do with self-awareness. In order to say what I mean as well as mean what I say, I need to be aware of myself and what it is I'm trying to communicate. So I'm going to talk to an individual about something, and perhaps it has to do with their behavior. It's something about them. I'm not just up there wanting to give a monologue, but it's a conversation, and perhaps I'm prompted to say what I want to say because of something they have said or something they are doing or aren't doing or whatever it is, but they're involved. So the sense data here, and what you would do with a sheet of paper like this, or just do in your own mind's eye, is to write down in this section some things that you notice. For example, what you see the person doing. What would be another? What else would you put in here?
Hear.
Okay, what we see, what we hear, or at least, you know, what we heard them say or do. What else?
Feel.
Okay. Feel and
touch.
Okay. I'm touching a feel, because feel comes up in another way with this awareness wheel, so I wanted to qualify that a little bit. What would be an example of some of these things? What might you see, for example?
What do people have on their faces, maybe?
Okay, a facial expression. Might even see a teardrop, or a smile, or hear what?
Tone of voice.
Very good. Tone of voice. Can hear someone crying, or moaning, or groaning, or a big sigh. This is sense data. What does it mean? Well, by itself, in a real clinical sort of way, the sense data is simply there. It's neutral. Could be a tear, you know, someone's crying, but I don't know if they're crying out of joy or if they're crying out of sadness. All the sense data tells me is, you know, this person is crying. So then we move to the second part, which I call it thoughts on this sheet. Some other expressions is would be interpretation. In other words, here's some sense data and now I start to interpret it. So these are the thoughts I have about it, or these are my ideas or concepts about what it is I have observed. Okay, now let's see. You hear someone's tone of voice, and let's say not only tone, but the speed. They're speaking very rapidly, and they're highly animated. And what might you think that person is experiencing?
Fear or excitement.
Okay, fear, could be excitement. There's certainly, pardon?
Agitation.
There's all kinds of possibilities. Now, when you come into a room, or the other person, let's say, comes rapidly into the room where you are and starts talking in this fashion, what might that do to you?
You respond.
What? Okay, and your response might include what?
Slow them down.
Okay, your response might involve some actions. And we'll jump over to here because what I want to illustrate at this point is you don't really go around this wheel in a mechanical fashion. It doesn't have to be clockwise or counterclockwise. You can start with any segment and move to any other segment. So you might do something like touch them, make some kind of contact, trying to slow them down, if nothing else, so that you don't get knocked over and you can hear what they're saying. So this part over here has to do with my, we're talking, because we're still, this is self-awareness, talking about my behavior, my actions.
Aren't your thoughts and interpretations going to be modified by past experience? Say it's one of your kids is crying, and mothers instinctively know that cry is they just stubbed their foot, or it's a certain cry and they say, and out the door they go. They know exactly there's something wrong, you see.
Yeah. There's a difference between a wet diaper cry, a hungry cry,
right.
A
absolutely.
Hurt cry.
Yeah.
And safety
pin. That's right.
And pardon?
A safety pin. Nowadays the girls don't have to worry about with these diapers, but we
yeah.
About safety pins.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. I
so
know.
You can see if a pin is open.
You bet. I've experienced that. So part of what goes on over here is my memories at work. But this is my cognitive functioning, the lenses through which I perceive things and by which I render them some kind of sense. They're organized, they're made sensical by the way that I cognitively process the rest of it through. This one, this section down here, I'll write it up here so it can be seen better. But this has to do with feelings. Of course, this section is missing in most men, is that right?
Yeah.
No, I don't think it's missing. It may not just be highlighted. But this is how I feel. If this is cognitive, this is visceral. So when somebody comes in the room and they're talking rapidly and they're highly animated and, you know, I get tense here. I get a response that, you know, I want to slow them down. I start to, what's going on? It's out of control. It's unpredictable. There are a lot of uncertainties, and I don't feel comfortable about that. So this has to do with my feelings as I observe things, and perhaps before I've even made any sense out of it. The last category down here has to do with wants. What is it that I wish, that I yearn for, that I hope will happen? What do I want to happen in this relationship with the other person, in particular at this point in time in the communication process? So as I sense things, as I think about it, and knowing what my feelings are, these are my wants. Now, what I would like to do is to try to make a little gap in here between wants and actions. Now remember, there's like 24 hours of material here, and we have 1 hour, so a lot of fine-tuning, a lot of additional points that could be made. But one of the things that I think is very important to bring in at this point, as far as encouraging people to talk, encouraging people to communicate openly, I think there is reluctance to do it because some of the things that I want or yearn for or some of my daydreams would really be very inappropriate if I actually did it. And so the step between wanting and doing it is a volitional step. Wants are in many ways like feelings. They're part of what I would call the autonomic nervous system. It's just there. You don't choose to feel scared. You don't really look at something and choose to find it attractive or wanting it. It's just there. It just presents itself. The experience, the internal experience, is just there. It's part of our human nature. Now the question is, what will you do with it?
Excuse me, would you call that daydreaming in there, in that small piece of pie?
Well, daydreaming in the sense of, here's something I would like to have, or something I would like to have happen. You know, whether you put it in here or whether you put it over here, at a certain point in time, this framework, which is a helpful tool, tends to break down if you try to make black and white distinctions. Different people will say, well, I think, you know, that fits over here more appropriately than over there. And it depends on the incident. But this has to do with, well, what do I want to have happen? You know, what do I hope for? If I owned the zoo, I know what I would do. I would put in this kind of an animal instead, and that kind, and I would take out these more familiar ones, you know. And in that sense, it's kind of daydreaming because it's fantasy. So just to underscore, there's a very intentional step between here and here. Just because I want it doesn't mean I get it or I cause it to happen or I act on my feelings. Did I see somebody raise a hand with a question?
Maybe I'm jumping ahead, but my question is, wouldn't it be better then to try to not have any expectations when you come into a relationship? In other words, your wants are expectations, in a sense.
Yeah. Well, that's a possibility. Expectations could be an extension of what I've known before and what's in the memory. Coming into a relationship without expectation, I wonder if that's really
maybe
possible.
Okay, but I was wondering if that wasn't sort of an ideal.
Coming in
without expectations, because then it would help you to maybe listen better. Or,
right.
You know.
Well,
if you don't dare to have expectations, then you will never have disappointments. But just think how sad a world it would be.
My hunch is that's very hypothetical, and that's not where we really experience ourselves. And rather than set up an ideal, or something, we'd say it would be desirable if we were this way. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to say, here's where I am. This is where we're at. This is what we do experience. Now, what do we do with it? Do we tuck it down inside and stay mum about it? Or can we be out and open and communicate? Yeah. And I think the journey in a relationship, we travel together, we progress together, as we can share together, as we talk about it, and then see what happens after that. That again, underscoring this gap here, that this is all negotiable, can be discussed before this sort of thing takes place.
What about needs? Where do you put them then? You have wants, but needs. Say in a relationship, somebody has athlete's foot, feet. He has to change his socks 3 times a day, and he needs to do this, or else his feet are going to fall off. I mean, that ought to be a good example.
Everybody. Yeah.
And so you say, hey, lady, let's go, but I got to change my socks before. And he explained that, or you just say, well, excuse me, I've got something to do, and away you go. Aren't you really better off to say, hey, I got bad feet and I got to do something with them?
There
are a whole bunch of things like that. Some people are diabetics. They gotta have an orange or something like that. A lot of people have problems with their contact lenses. I got to go change them, or I got to wash them out. You know, those aren't really wants. They're just plain needs.
Abraham Maslow has a hierarchy of needs, and it starts out with survival needs. You know, food, oxygen.
It might be your AIDS that's creeping, but not mine.
Abraham Maslow.
Did I speak my mind clear enough that everybody understood that?
Well, okay. Are you acquainted with Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
See.
Yeah.
Okay. What these authors say is that's over here. They don't really buy into Maslow very strongly. And I'm not going to argue one side or the other, but they put this stuff over here as part of the interpretive process. Given the athlete's foot, there are various options, and having thought it through or having some ideas about it, whether it's medical or physical or, I mean, athletic, you know, this is what a person has thought about doing, and then they may want to do it. So
is that also where outside obligations or external expectations also go in the schematics in that same quadrant?
Right. This part over here with the memory part, the cognitive part, would have to do with you know, commitments or things that have been worked out in a cognitive sense previously. So the prior history is over here.
External limitations, for example, you just don't have any things for your athlete's foot. There are certain limitations. Does that also kind of go in that area?
Some things we consider non-negotiable. Okay, but the fact that we consider it to be non-negotiable, or we think it to be non-negotiable, that's over here. You know, some people would say, well, gravity's non-negotiable, but other people would say, no, I think not. Some people would say, well, you know, you can go down all kinds of medical things or theoretical physics or whatever, and what we have thought the world ought, we usually still think the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. We'd say that's non-negotiable. Well, Einstein would say, no, you thought it was, but later on discover it isn't. So a lot of that sort of stuff these people would put over here, saying it's not part of reality, capital R. It has to do with our perception and interpretation of this sense data. So they really want to say, no, let's keep it wide open all the time. But wants and needs over here is different than Maslow. Yes?
You're talking about relationships. Are you talking male-female relationships? Are you talking male-to-male or female-to-female? Or,
yes.
You know, some of us are. You're talking about every relationship you're ever going to come across in your lifetime? Or is it one of these intimate things you're talking about?
Oh, well, okay, I'm glad you asked that, because what that can do is move us to the next step, at least get us on that direction. Right at this point, I'm just talking about self-awareness in a relationship. Now, when you pull up to the service station and get gasoline, you know, you're not going to listen to what, you know, the person says, well, how much do you want? And you're going to say, well, let's see, I heard them ask a question. And you're not going to go through all of this antics here for that kind of a brief encounter. So it's not every relationship with every person that you would be processing it in this kind of a fashion. But as far as intimacy is concerned, the point here is that the more parts of the awareness wheel that I use, the more parts that I include in a given conversation, the more I'm sharing of myself. And hence, you know, as that is reciprocated, as that's continued, the more intimate that relationship is, the more intimate the communication is. But not only more intimate, the more parts of this that are used, the greater the chance is that I know what it is I'm trying to communicate, and I get it communicated, the more likely I will be understood by the more parts I use. The fewer parts of these things that would be in a statement that I would make with somebody, the greater the chance of being misunderstood. You know, if I tell somebody, you're really being inconsiderate. Well, what did they do that was inconsiderate? I didn't share the sense data, and I didn't really share anything about myself, in fact. How their behavior affected me, I didn't share that. I just attacked them with a...
Now you're talking to a total stranger. You're not talking to your son or your daughter and saying you really were inconsiderate there.
Well,
you have every right to say that, don't you, if you're the authority figure in your family?
Well, I may have the right to say that to my children, but the question that I'm asking is, will they understand what I'm talking about?
And then they can say, well, why? When you say, well, you plumb right over their feet, you didn't say, excuse me. You reached in and grabbed something.
Yeah. My experience with my kids is they don't say why if they experience me being authoritarian. They just kind of cringe, and if it's a hierarchical arrangement and this person up here is exercising the power, this person down here, if they just submit, if they're just subservient, they clam up. When people can talk, when they can discuss, and we're talking about an egalitarian relationship, about equals, about partners, about colleagues. And so I would want the other person to be able to discuss with me. And since that's what I would want and feel comfortable with, what I think I should do is utilize as many parts of the awareness wheel as I can in that kind of a conversation.
So give us an example of how you would go about doing it in the correct way.
Pardon?
So give an example of how you would do it in the correct way.
Okay. What would be an incident?
Being rude.
Okay. And what might somebody do? What might be a rude behavior?
Climb over the feet of someone. You could use for example.
Okay. Now, if you saw an individual just climbing over somebody's feet and probably stepping on them in the process, what would you think?
Getting ready to regurgitate. I want to get out of his way.
Yeah. Pardon me, I got to get up in the bathroom.
Hope he doesn't say, excuse me.
Well.
Okay, now that would depend upon whether he's coming in or going out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, let's just say we're sitting in the same room. I was thinking there were three of us. I'm sitting here, you're sitting there, and somebody's climbing, one of my daughters is climbing over your feet. Well, that was the picture, was it?
Well,
I want to check that
out.
Just
say, honey, that wasn't very nice. You should be more careful or more sensitive.
Okay, before I say anything, though, what I'm asking is, what might I be thinking as I observe that action?
Well, I would see them climbing over the feet. I would think that that behavior is not acceptable behavior in our society. I would interpret it as being rude or inconsiderate.
Depending upon the circumstance, you might also feel embarrassed that other person feels I'm an improper parent because I didn't teach my kid right manners.
Okay, embarrassed. And what would I want?
An apology. Well, just see, next time I'll try to remember.
A change behavior, apology would be change behavior.
Okay, now what would I do? This is getting to your question. Oh, I would say something, wouldn't I? Well, you know, somebody might say, well, I'd reach over and grab him by the back of the collar and pick him up and set him down. That would be doing something. I mean, as far as this diagram goes, that would be appropriate. That's action. You were going
to
say?
Yeah, it depends on age. I mean, when you get to people that are becoming adults, you don't do that because you crush them in public. But
right.
You walk out and you say, I want to talk to you for a moment. You walk out in the hall and you say, hey, that was a dumb idea to do that. I now want to see it again. And then you drop it and you go back in. But if they're little tiny kids, you grab them by the nape of the neck and say, hey, wait a minute now, you don't step on other people's feet. Because they don't have that sense of being scolded or being ridiculed or being becoming inferior, like they're just a dumb kid. You know, I don't know.
How many parents are willing to say, the reason I got upset was I was embarrassed, you know, it reflected on me. I mean, we don't say that to our kids. And should we say that to our kids? Is it appropriate to tell our kids?
No.
No, I don't think you need to be apologetic to your kids when you corrected them. In the process of growing up, we're supposed to train our children. When they're young, so that when they're old, they'll know how to act.
Yeah. Okay. And then
one thing that I think it creates problems oftentimes, you have your wants. You want the change behavior. You want them to behave in an appropriate manner. What is the proper action? I mean, oftentimes the thing that you sort of impulsively do maybe isn't necessarily the thing that's going to get the result that you want. How do you obtain the result? I mean, I find that with my kids sometimes maybe what I would impulsively, maybe grabbing him by the back of the neck and haul him over and sit him down, maybe that doesn't necessarily, in the end result, get them to next time do what I want them to do.
Right, because that isn't being sensitive. When you're trying to tell them to be sensitive, your behavior to them was not sensitive.
But probably you can tell them that wasn't very considerate when you did that, though.
Yeah. What is the proper action to get the result that isn't always clear to
Between adults, wouldn't it be, who are you to tell me?
What the authors of this material do, the section that deals with self-awareness, is first go through the awareness wheel and as we've done, say, highlight, well, what this area deals with, what this section deals with. Now, given the awareness, as we move into actions, in particular speaking, as you were asking, there are five parts here, they have six steps that they emphasize, six how-tos that you practice. And the first one is what Thomas Gordon in the PET material calls I messages, not meaning EYE, eyeball, but I, me, myself, and I. Speaking for myself rather than you, which is attacking or claiming that I know something about you, whether you agree with it or not, you know, this is a label, this is an epistemological claim I make about you. Well, people get defensive of that. No, I'm going to argue with that. I take exception to that, et cetera, et cetera. So the first step is speak for oneself. And then the other five steps just go right around here. I saw, I heard, I felt, I noticed, and so I think.
All right, you guys, it makes me feel good about myself.
Okay, one thing is not good enough. Get out of your way, lightly. When someone's trying to get in and out, don't you politely turn your feet for them to move? I mean, I didn't want to disturb you talking, and I didn't want to block her way, and I wanted to get through fast. And besides, why do we have to be up here anyway? I mean, that's really
because he said it's from home. Pardon?
Maybe I just used the wrong example.
I know people who are blood related who go in this direction. Yeah.
Do you ever think the problem with this type of a wheel, where because of cultural differences, one person takes it as being submissive and being actually a sign of weakness? You know, some cultures don't go for this type of thing. They don't go for this sort of thing.
The whole idea. That's right.
Wouldn't let her to
irk
on me, so.
you were saying.
I don't care.
And so this business of self-awareness, what I identify is what I want. And I can speak and act accordingly, but what the other person does is not always in my control and usually isn't in my control. I can't shape, model, I can't intrude and force on them. Right. A hand over here.
Which process comes first, because of regarding thoughts or feelings, the person will react emotionally often before thinking, before interaction.
Right, and so if I see this stepping on the feet behavior happening, it's very likely that I'll have a feeling response, a visceral response, before I can even think it through. So it doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in this fashion. It can, you know, go from here to here and over to here and then back to here and then, you know. This is a framework which just says these are the different parts of a communication process to have in mind. The more that are used, the better. Now, you may say that's an assumption that it's the better. And I will acknowledge that. It is an assumption. And another culture might make a different assumption. I agree with the authors that the more the better. But that's an assumption.
Again, my assumption is that we live in a culture that values the thought and the quadrant, and we think things through. But if you're an advertising executive designing a commercial for your product, who takes in obviously all these quadrants and wanting to get you to buy the product, I think looking at our commercials, their assumption is that the feeling and the wanting is a much larger quadrant than the thought one. So maybe we're fooling ourselves, at least based upon the cultural impact of commercials or advertising.
Sure. Yeah.
And we hit it right on the nose, because commercials are 15% knowledge and 85% emotion. That's an altogether different situation. I mean, it's selling is enthusiasm. You don't have to know zip about what you're selling. Have you talked to a used car salesman lately? You know, I mean, it's all emotion. You know, you've got to have this. Boy, you look good in that car.
And that's the way it is now, but that's not the way it used to be. It used to be that we were given commercials that told us why, in a reasonable sense, a certain product was better than other products. But that's not the practice anymore. As selling has gotten more sophisticated, as we know more about ourselves and about each other and about what does motivate buying habits, it has a lot to do with this part down here, which we thought we could hide, which we thought we just keep mum about, and we pride ourselves in being so intelligent and sophisticated and technologically astute. But so much of life is lived in this realm. That's important. Go ahead.
It relates to the commercial thing too, but if when we're talking about children, something is authority. Obviously, some people believe that they are the authority when they're raising their children.
They are. God willed that way.
Well, you have to decide at what point you're not the authority. And I, from my experience, it was about when they were three. I realized they had to learn to live their own life. And, you know, obviously, by the time they're 13 and 16, it's too late. But I think authority is something that comes into marriage relationships, into friendship relationships, into who's got the authority. And by getting back to saying I, that's at least putting you in contact, that's what I feel. Not that you are wrong because I'm the authority. But I think we're getting off a little when we're talking about kids, because then it's real easy to have a big argument as to who's the boss. And that isn't what we're here, well, we are.
And I think we
am
need
I the
model.
Boss of you?
We need a model for our kids. I teach first and second grade, and the word welcome is thank you and please, we can get in there. But the word welcome is not in their vocabulary, and it's because when they say thank you, we're not saying you're welcome back. They're supposed to say it. We don't have to because we're adults. They're supposed to say thank you. But how many times do we say you're welcome back?
Because I learned it too way down when I was a little kid.
They have to have models that are using. If they hear and they respect you, they're going to copy you.
Did I tell you about 1,000 units of moral value? Okay. Well, I'll just throw this in. It's certainly tangential to this, but related to the discussion. Real briefly, the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church is highly invested in the educational system. The statistics that I'm aware of are for every 2 congregations, there's 1 elementary school, usually attached to the church building. They of course have the confirmation program, Sunday school, vacation Bible school, and all the rest. So they're very invested in educating youngsters. And so they did a research project of no small magnitude to determine how effective their program is. So they said if each person has 1,000 units of moral value, doesn't say what kind of morals you have, but everybody is made up of 1,000 units of moral value. Their question, of course, was, where do those units come from? Who has the influence? Their response was that the majority come from the parents. They said 550 of those 1,000 are what the parents model. That doesn't mean the youngster's behavior is identical, but the values, what is important, what do we spend our time on, what do we spend our money on, what do we worry about, what do we strive for, the parental model is 550 of those 1,000 units. So that's significant. The rest of the story is, for the Missouri Synod, the test case was, how influential are they on youngsters whose parents are not highly involved in the church? Because that's really the test case. Otherwise, you see, you have the influence of that 550. So if you take that 550 away, how much does the church get? And I'll give you a couple of guesses. What do you think they came up with? There's 450 left. So how many of the 450 does the church get?
55,
a man says.
Specifically of the church or of the church school?
Well, how much does in this case, the Missouri Synod, through their whole parochial educational system, the whole business? 125, you're going in the wrong direction from 55.
Maybe 5.
I thought you were
10%. I said
50. 50, okay, you're way high, way high. And 10 is still generous. 3.
Oh, 3.
So, you know, are they shutting down? You know, they're so highly invested in it. Only thing they could do is put that study on the shelf. You know, they couldn't change direction.
Yeah.
So, which is, I wonder, they were hoping they could compliment themselves for a job well done, and instead they just, you know.
And Missouri Synod has one of the best records of day schools, the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
The Episcopal and some of the others. Well, then what's the point in allowing your children to go to a parochial school?
Yeah. Well, that's the big question. We teach students and play with adults. It's interesting, in the New Testament example, Jesus teaches adults and plays with children. Well, anyway, that's a whole other agenda. I want to get back to this.
what I wanted to underscore is the significant role of the parents. 550 out of 1,000, and nothing else came that close inside. So the parental role model is critical. Sir?
How did they arrive at the demon that seemed so carefully subjective?
Well, that's right. They had to pick some kind of numbers, and I really don't know what their particular rationale was. They could have started with 100, or they could have said 10,000. It's just a statistical result. And there are exceptions to that, because that study and the results, those are numbers. Then when you look at individual people, you could say, well, I know a kid who, et cetera, you know, was the opposite.
Maybe it isn't the whole system, but that teacher, that first or second teacher that child has, yeah, will make a big impact on that child.
It's important. Ma'am.
I think when I was growing up, maybe the parents had about 900 children. When I brought my children up, they probably had 750. Now it's down to 550. It should be back up to 900.
And sometimes we think it's on its way down to 150.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think it's a whole different way of life, from the time I was brought up and then from the time you were brought up, and now when you're bringing up the children now, that's another whole different way of life. The whole shift in culture. So we can't all think the same on this wheel because of the way we have been brought up.
Right. I I'm glad you said that, because when I talk about my self-awareness, I have to own that. That's how I think, that's how I feel, and by my saying I, as was pointed out earlier, what that does is it releases for the other person to have their thoughts and their feelings and their wants, which may not and probably aren't identical to mine. But that's where the communication process is encouraged. Because I'm not going to claim to know what you think or feel. I'll only share what I think or feel. And the awareness wheel now becomes a tool not only for expressing what I mean, and the more I'm aware of it, meaning then what I say so that I don't misrepresent myself. It's not only a tool for this, but if there's somebody with whom I want a closer, more open relationship, about whom I want to know more, and they say something to me, maybe they tell me what they're feeling, immediately I've got four questions. Oh, what led you to have that feeling? And what do you think about it? And what do you want? And so I can encourage the other person to be more open with me, to say what they want, and I can follow it up by saying, well, if I care about them, how might I modify my behavior? But I don't know that if they only tell me what their feelings are, because I really don't know what behavior of mine brought that about, etc. So this awareness wheel is helpful for my expressing myself, but it's also a helpful tool that I can use in facilitating the communication so that I better hear the other person.
One of the problems that I've run into in my life is communication, is that I've always dealt with the technical end of language. And sometimes, you get so used to speaking it amongst your peers that when you start to talk to other people, they don't understand what you're talking about, and you don't even realize they don't understand what you're talking about. I mean, all you have to do is talk to your 20-year-old kids and then start talking about them ones, and it just drives me up a wall, you see? And many, many times when I get talking to people that are younger than I am, particularly, I have to say, Hina, what do you mean by what you said? I mean, what does that mean to you? Because it means something to me different, I think, than what they're really trying to express. And that is the biggest snag in all of this, is not understanding what they're saying. The words don't convey the thought.
Although I think you just illustrated this awareness wheel when you say to the other person, when you use this word, I don't know what you mean, and I'd like to know. So I'm asking you, what do you mean? Yeah. Which illustrates the awareness wheel, and you
problem.
Communicate to
and
them.
And it's side assumption.
No.
Like the word neat, when we grew up, the word neat meant something entirely different. And when Ollie North and some of those said it was a neat idea. In our day, ideas weren't neat.
Yeah.
People were neat. Or
rooms were. The three copper arrows were, or the gay copper arrows was a really a nice song. Remember that one? I think that's, you know, now you don't even talk about that.
Okay, is that then what, say, I would do if I were talking to another adult who did not express anything? Was always talking about someone out there or what's wrong with what's going on out there and never expressed any of his own feelings.
Well, what might I do if I'm talking to somebody and I have this tool in my toolbox but I don't think they do in theirs?
Yeah.
And what would I do? And I think the appropriate thing is to say, I have heard you say whatever it was they said, and I think this or that about that, but I'm curious, that's my thinking, about how you feel. What happens to you inside when this or that happens?
But I think you know, in terms of breaking down that logjam, one of the ways simply is to model that behavior and share your own feelings.
Right, that's very important. But the point that I was wanting to make right here was not just to walk in and, well, how do you feel about that? Because it really puts that person on the spot. And so by sharing myself and by saying that I'm curious or I'm puzzled, you know, and so it opening the door, but not trying to push them through it.
And that's been one of the...
Pardon?
You can be offensive by this type of thing.
That's right.
And some of these newer Christians, born-again Christians, well, they're almost attacking anybody. You may be a Christian 75 years, but they think if you didn't have the same experience they had, you're really, you know, going the wrong way.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways that people can really be intrusive towards others.
You have to respect other people's sensibilities, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I think that's appropriate. I think so. Okay, we didn't take time to write on this and then sit down and share it or come back with it, but that introduces the material. I hope that's helpful, and I want to illustrate with this book here that I've been plugging for the last couple days how Richardson has taken a lot of literature and distilled it down into here. So when he talks about family systems and different problems, and then he gets to the last part, well, now what do you do about it? On one page he says, if the person you are with keeps talking about others, you keep asking, and how did that affect you? And what did that mean to you? And what did you think about that? Your interest is in what meaning others assign to an event. Rarely... Now here's the sentence, keep your eye over here. Rarely does another member of the family let others in on what's going on inside of them by saying, when you said that, I thought you meant ... and so I felt ... and I decided I wanted to ... and that's why I did what I did, leaving open for the particulars. Well, as soon as I read that, I knew what Richardson had also been reading. And he's done that with a lot of the really academic literature, distilled it down, and it's a marvelous little book. Family Ties That Bind, An Introduction to Family Systems, which I plugged the last 2 days. And now you know the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And if you don't have it, at least how to go out and get it, right? Thank you very much for a very good question.